Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning poet C.K. Williams. Williams is the author of 9 books of poetry, the most recent of which, The Singing, won the 2003 National Book Award. His previous book, Repair, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. And his collection, Flesh and Blood, received the National Book Critics Circle Award. We begin tonight with an introduction by former United States Poet Laureate Robert Pensky.
I welcome you to the first of the Robert Lowell Memorial Lecture Series in the spirit of Room 222. As many of you know, Room 222 at 236 Bay State Road is where Robert Lowell taught a class in the late 50s, and amongst the students in that class were Ann Sexton, George Starbuck, and Sylvia Plath. The spirit of Room 222, and I thank my friend Nancy Livingston Levin for giving us the title, the spirit of that room was not only that there are a lot of really terrific poets in it once, it's the room where Rosanna Warren, Leslie Epstein, Derek Walcott, Hodgin, and I still teach BU's writing seminars. The spirit embodied by that extraordinary group of people is the spirit in which the art of writing comes first. By a happy coincidence, some of them were students. One of them was a teacher at the time. The main point was they were devoted to the art of poetry in some way that may be different from pedagogy in things other than art. Everybody was the same, to use the word Shakespeare uses in Antony and Cleopatra, competitors. We think of competition as vying against one another. Competitor, they say it when they're being nice to one another, triumphant, my great competitor. We seek the same thing. In that spirit, we're inaugurating the series with our reader, C.K. Williams. It's fitting that C.K. Williams, so supremely a poet of meaning that personal striving of the soul out of itself, begins our series. His poetic sequence, A Dream of Mind, is one of the great contemporary meditations on the meaning and spirit of art in the mind. An ideal of art and of art as connected to every part of life, every part of thought, is prominent in his work and has inspired many other living poets besides me. The significance of his poems on political subjects and political feelings is political, but also a matter of poetics. These poems affirm that everything, including politics, is part of poetry's rightful terrain. C.K. Williams's most recent book is The Singing. His 1999 book, Repair, won the Pulitzer Prize. His 1987 book, Flesh and Blood, won the National Book Critics Circle Award. He has won lots of other prizes, and he is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Boston University's writing program is honored that he is our first Robert Lowell Memorial Lecturer in the spirit of Room 222, and I happen to know that he is currently thinking about and writing about intellectual beauty. Here he is to embody it, C.K. Williams.
That was a wonderful introduction, except he left out that I too taught in 222. I taught here for a year. My office was 221, and I taught in 222. Sounds like a French poem. I was very, when Jill was talking about Robert as a teacher and good teachers and bad teachers, and she was talking about bad teachers being boring, that just flashed back to my freshman year in college. I went to my freshman year to Bucknell University, then I changed. but it was out in the middle of the hills of Pennsylvania, and it was always snowing and cold and windy and bitter. And I had a class, I assure you won't believe this, at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. And Friday night, we did what students do on Friday nights. So it was always quite a struggle to get there. And we had a teacher, it was an English class, of course, who would lecture looking out the window. He never looked at us. He would just talk looking out the window. I mean, I don't remember a word he might possibly have said. He may have been in room 222 for all we know as well. The singing. I was walking home down a hill near our house on a balmy afternoon under the blossoms of the pear trees that go flamboyantly mad here every year, every spring, with their burgeoning forth. When a young man turned in from a corner singing, no, it was more of a cadence shouting, most of which I couldn't catch, I thought because the young man was black, speaking black. It didn't matter. I could tell he was making his song up, which pleased me. He was nice-looking, husky, dressed in some style of big pants, obviously full of himself, hence his lyrical flowing over. We went along in the same direction, then he noticed me there almost beside him. And big, he shouted, saying, big. And I thought how droll to have my height incorporated in his song. So I smiled. But the face of the young man showed nothing. He looked, in fact, pointedly away, and his song changed. I'm not a nice person, he chanted. I'm not a nice person. No menace was meant, I gathered, no particular threat, but he did want to be certain I knew that if my smile implied I conceived of anything like concord between us, I should forget it. That's all. Nothing else happened. His song became indecipherable to me again. He arrived where he was going, a house where a girl in braids waited for him on the porch. That was all. No one saw, no one heard. All the unasked and unanswered questions were left where they were. It occurred to me to sing back, I'm not a nice person either, but I couldn't come up with a tune. Besides, I wouldn't have meant it, nor he have believed it. Both of us knew just where we were in the duet we composed, the equation we made, the conventions to which we were condemned. Sometimes it feels, even when no one is there, that someone, something, is watching and listening, someone to rectify, redo, remake. This time again, though, no one saw nor heard. No one was there. I hate drinking out of a bottle in front of all these people. Can't Boston University afford glasses? It's true, think of it. Although these days everybody is always carrying a bottle around. There's two things in the world that have changed since I was at Boston University. One is everybody's always carrying a bottle around, and the other is that everybody's always talking on a cell phone. And I walked through the campus, I realized, wait, nobody looks the way they did. They all are looking like that. This happened. There's a reference here to a lycée, which, of course, is a French high school. The event of the poem happened in France, where I live sometimes. This happened. A student, a young woman, in a fourth-floor hallway of her lycée, perched on the ledge of an open window, chatting with friends between classes. A teacher passes and chides her. Be careful, you might fall. Almost banteringly chides her. You might fall. And the young woman, 18, a girl really, though she wouldn't think that, as brilliant as she is, first in her class, and beautiful too, she's often told, smiles back and leans into the open window, which wouldn't even be open if it were winter. If it were winter, someone would have closed it. Close it. Leans into the window, farther, still smiling, farther and farther, though it takes less time than this, really an instant, and lets herself fall. Herself fall. A casual impulse, a fancy, never thought of until now, hardly thought of even now. No, more than impulse or fancy, the girl knows what she's doing. The girl means something. The girl means to mean, because it occurs to her in that instant that beautiful or not, bright yes or no, she's not who she is. She's not the person she is. And the reason she suddenly knows is that there's been so much premeditation where she is, so much plotting and planning. There's hardly a person where she is, or if there is, it's not her, or not wholly her. It's a self inhabited, lived in by her. And seemingly, even as she thinks it, she knows what's been missing. Grace. Not premeditation, but grace. A kind of being in the world spontaneously. With grace. Waitfully upon me was the world. Waitfully this self which graced the world, yet never wholly itself. Waitfully this self which weighed upon me, the release from which is what I desire and what I achieve. And the girl remembers in this infinite instant already so many times divided, the grief she felt once, hardly knowing she felt it, to merely inhabit herself. Yes, the girl falls, absurd to fall. Even the earth, with its compulsion to take unto itself all that falls, must know that falling is absurd. Yet the girl falling isn't myself, or she is myself, but a self I took of my own volition unto myself. Forever, with grace, this happened. I'll read some new poems and then come back to some old ones, maybe. This one is called Cows. There's a reference in it to Io, who was a figure in Greek mythology. She was one of Zeus's many seductees, do you say? He seduced her, and then when his wife Athena was about to appear on the scene, he panicked and changed her into a cow, a heifer. It comes to a, she, in the poem it says she was so beautiful still that men would fall in love with her. And the story has a happy ending because her name in Greek is just a line and a circle. And at one point when everyone's around her, she makes a line and then a circle so they know it's really her. And as I recall, I think Zeus therefore changes her back. Who knows, she might have been happier as a heifer, though. Cows. Face in her hands, bike thrown down beside her, a girl on the road from the village stands brokenheartedly crying. I assume it's some love thing, but stop a ways on to be sure. In a meadow nearby, 10 or so spotted heifers, each with a numbered tag in her ear, see me and rush to the fence and low over, all of them, all at once, with so much feeling that not feed me, do they seem to be saying, but save me, save me, save me, save me. Still long-legged, still svelte, their snug skin milk-white and gleaming obsidian black. I think of Io, transfigured by treacherous Zeus to a heifer whose beauty was still such men longed to embrace her. These, by next year, unless they're taken to slaughter, will be middle-aged ladies with udders indifferently grazing. When I look in the mirror, the girl, should I have offered to help her, is gone. I'll never know what happened to her. Nor what will. The cows watch still, jaws grinding, tails lashing the squadrons of flies on their back, on their flanks. Save me, save me. A lot of my poems now, I've left city life and I live in the country half the year. So a lot of my poems are about animals and such things. I'm not so sure about what this is going to do to my life. I often think of that there was a comedian named Buddy Hackett, who used to be on television all the time. And he told a joke about how when he was growing up, he grew up on Jewish food. And without knowing it, he always had heartburn. And when he was drafted into the army, his heartburn went away, and he thought his vital fire had gone out. So maybe that's what's happening to me. This is called Peggy. The name of the horse of my friend's friend, a farmer's son, whose place we'd pass when we rode out that way, I remember. Not his name, just his mare's, Peggy, a gleaming, well-built gray, surprising, considering her one-stall plank shed. I even recall where they lived, half-acre road, it sounds like frost. I went back not long ago. It's paved now, with rows on both sides of those tract mansions that look like multiple family apartment houses. One lot hadn't been built on, so I stopped and went through and found that behind the wall of garages and hydrants, the woods had stayed somehow intact and wild, wilder, the paths overgrown, the derelict pond a sink of weeds. We'd gallop by there, up a hill, our horses' flanks foaming with sweat. Then we'd skirt Peggy's fields and cross to more woods, more fields than a meadow, the scent of which once, new-mown hay, was so sweet I taste it still. But now the false mullioned windows, the developer's scrawny maples, the lawns, I didn't know what to do with it all. It just ached, like forgetting someone you love is dead and wanting to call them, and then you remember, and they're dead again. I sent that poem to Robert, actually, and he made a suggestion. See, we teach each other our whole lives. I had the scrawny developer's maples, and he said, are you referring to these skinny developers? And no, it's the developer's scrawny maples. Thrush. Often in our garden these summer evenings, a thrush and her two nearly grown offspring come to forage. The chicks are fledged, the mother's teaching them to find their own food. One learns, the other can't. Its skull is misshapen. There's no eye on one side, and the beak is malformed. Whatever it finds, it drops. It seems to regress then, crouching before the mother, gullet agape as though it were back in the nest. She always finds something else for it to eat, but her youngster's all but as large as she is. She's feeding two of herself. She'll abandon it soon and migrate. The chick will doubtlessly starve. Humans don't do that. Just leave. Though a young woman I saw rushing through the train station this morning with a Down syndrome infant in a stroller, I thought might if she could. The child, a girl, was giggling so hard at how splendidly fast they were going that she'd half fallen from her seat until the mother braked abruptly, hissed, shush, and yanked her back into place. The baby, alarmed, subsided, but still intrepidly smiled as the mother, she wasn't 18, with smudged eyeliner, scuffed shoes, and a cardboard valise, sped on, wielding carriage and child as a battering ram through the oncoming rush. The thrushes have been rapidly crisscrossing the lawn in and out of the flower beds all through the long dusk. Now they leave. The rest of the birds go quiet. I can hear someone far off calling children to bed. And it's the turn of the bats, who materialize, vanish, and appear again, their own after selves, their own ghosts. Here's another sort of companion poem to that that does different things. It's called Blackbird. There was nothing I could have done. A flurry of blackbirds burst from the weeds at the edge of a field, and one veered out into my wheel and went under. I had a moment to hope he'd emerge, as sometimes they will, from beneath the back of the car and fly off, but I saw him behind on the roadbed, the shadowless sail of a wing lifted vainly from the clumsy bundle of matter he'd become. There was nothing I could have done, though perhaps I was distracted. I'd been listening to news of the war, hearing that what we'd suspected were lies had proved to be lies, that many were dying for those lies, but as usual now, it wouldn't matter. I'd been thinking of Lincoln's "You can't fool all of the people all of the time," how I once took comfort from the hope and trust it implied, but no longer. I had to slow down now. A tractor hauling a load of hay was approaching on the narrow lane. The farmer and I gave way and waved. The high-piled bales swayed menacingly over my head, but held. Out in the harvested fields, already disked and raw, more blackbirds, uncountable clouds of them, rose, held for an instant, then broke, scattered, as though by a gale. I'll read a poem. Some of these poems I've never read before, so if I mispronounce words or something, please forgive me. This one I can't resist. There's so many poets in the audience. This is called Fish. On the sidewalk in front of a hairdresser supply store lay the head of a fish, largest, pointy, perhaps a pike's. It must recently have been left there. Its scales shone in its visible eye, had enough light left in it still, so it looked, as they will for a while, astonished and disconsolate to have been brought to such a pass. Its incision was clean, brutal, precise. It had to have come in one blow. In the showcase window behind, other heads, women's and men's, bewigged, painstakingly coiffed, stared out as though at the fish, as though stunned, aghast too, though they were hardly surprised. Hadn't they known all along that life, that frenzy, that folly, that flesh thing would come sooner or later to this? It hurts life just as much as it might, and it ends always like this. Better stay here with eyes of glass, like people in advertisements, and without bodies or blood, like people in poems. Was that for the poets? Or the... Now, this is a quite unusual poem. It's the first poem I've ever written quite like this. It's called The Blade, and it's dated November 3rd, 2004, which some of you ancient historians will remember was the day after our last election. I'm told Massachusetts is a blue state, so I won't have to worry about being attacked by too many people. It's a definitely blue state poem, I'm sorry. The Blade. Usually I don't mind that being out of the city now means still having to endure the drone of planes, traffic on the ubiquitous highways, mowers and buzz saws. They've become almost a part of the music of nature. But this morning, the builder's men clearing the woods facing our house, the roar of their truck hauling away the old oaks, and the screech of the blade of their dozer scraping the stony soil seem beyond bearing. Though in truth, of course, it's the sorrowful election. Nothing ever like this. Calls and emails since dawn, everyone I know struck with the same sense of humiliation and betrayal, then even revulsion. That a campaign could succeed relying entirely on the most shameless fear-mongering, slander, and lies. And beyond that, the hopeless foreboding that something irrevocable, irremediable, is underway. In Spain, during the reign of Franco, I blundered into a vast rally he'd arranged for himself, a butcher who jailed them for decades in a dark age of army and church. His people couldn't cheer him enough. For a moment, when the swarming mob surged, I was lifted bodily and swept towards a line of tanks, frightening, fighting not to fall, awful, those bodies heaving against me, pulling me down. The workmen have parked their infernal contraptions, left them idling, and gone into some bushes to piss. Their excavator must have burned something out. It whines, hammers like a blacksmith forging chain, and unfurls a dense brown miasma of diesel that spreads far into the fields and hangs there as though the ground itself were aflame, the whole world afire, consuming itself. Is our political anguish realistic? Always before, whatever party of regression has been in ascendance, the under voices of reason and tolerance were audible somehow. Aren't they now? I don't know. I'm frightened, but I don't know. On a distant hill, a splash of fresh emerald, winter wheat, closer, just across, only stumps and the slashed, fuming earth. This is called The Gaff. The first stanza is a little naughty, so maybe I'll read it twice. It's just two lines. The Gaff. If that someone who's me, yet not me, yet who judges me, is always with me as he is, shouldn't he have been there when I said so long ago that thing I said? I will read it again. It took so long to get that right. I kept having the wrong modifier and the wrong but. If that someone who's me yet not me, yet who judges me, is always with me as he is, shouldn't he have been there when I said so long ago that thing I said? If he who rakes me with such not trivial shame for minor sins now were there then, shouldn't he have warned me he'd even now devastate me for my unpardonable affront? I'm a child then, yet already I've composed this conscience beast who harries me. Is there anything else I can say with certainty about who I was, except that I, that he, could already draw from infinitesimal transgressions complex chords of remorse and orchestrate ever undiminishing retribution from the hapless rest of myself? The son of some friends of my parents has died. And my parents, paying their call, take me along, and I'm sent out with the dead boy's brother and some others to play. We're hanging around, and words come to my mind, which to my amazement are said. How do you know when you can laugh when somebody dies? Your brother dies, is what's said. And the others go quiet. The backyard goes quiet. Everyone stares. And I want to know now why that someone in me who's me yet not me, let me say it. Shouldn't he have told me the contrition cycle would from then be ever upon me? It didn't matter that I'd really only wanted to know how grief ends and when. I could hear the boy's mother sobbing inside, then stopping, sobbing, then stopping. Was the end of her grief already there? Had her someone in her told her it would end? Was there someone in her kinder to her, not tearing at her as mine did, still does, me, for guessing grief someday ends? Is that why her sobbing stopped sometimes? She didn't laugh, though, or I never heard her. How do you know when you can laugh? Why couldn't someone have been there in me, not just to accuse me, to explain? The kids were playing again. I was playing. I didn't hear anything more from inside. the way now sometimes what's in me is silent too, and sometimes even forgets. We. A basset hound with balls so heavy they hang a harrowing half inch from the pavement, ears cocked, accusingly watches as his beautiful mistress croons to her silver cell phone. She does, yes, go on, but my, so slim-waistedly does she sway there, so engrossedly does her dark gaze drift towards even, for a moment, mine. Though Mr. Dog, of course, sits down right then to lick himself, his groin, of course, till she cuts off and he, gathering his folds and flab, heaves erect to leave with her. But wait, she's turning to a great Ducati cycle gleaming black and chromy at the curb. She's mounting it, that long, strong lift of flank, snorting it to life, coaxing it in gear. Why, she's not his at all, no more than mine. What was he thinking? What was I? Like a wing, a wave, she banks away now, downshifts, pops and crackles round the curve, is gone. How sleek she was, though, how scruffy, how anciently scabby, we, he and I, how worn, how self-devoured, balls and all. Balls, balls and all. This is another poem I've never read, another poet's poem, sort of saddening. Saddening worse to read in frost at midnight Coleridge's ecstatic hymn to his newborn son, Hartley, for whom he imagines, quote, all seasons shall be sweet, unquote, and to find in the biographies how depressingly the father, their relationship deteriorated when the boy was grown, the father struggling between his dependence on opiates and the exertions of his recalcitrant genius, the son trying to separate from the mostly absent but still intimidating father. Their final contact has Hartley, a neophyte poet himself, he'll never attain stature, abandoning his father in the street, Coleridge in tears, not knowing, as though he were a character in one of the more than minor tragedies he might have written if his life had evolved more fortuitously, how to begin to reconcile his unspoken suffering with his son's, how to conceive of healing the hurt both had to have felt before they each reeled back to their respective isolation. The myth was already in effect then, Wordsworth's doing, that creativity like Coleridge's thrives best in seclusion. Even Coleridge, though his poem takes place with his son beside him and friends sleeping yards away, speaks of that solitude which suits abstruser musings. So generations of writers go off to the woods to find alcohol, Schwartz, Lowry, too many others to mention, depression, or even Lowell, one hates to say it, wife abuse. Coleridge, in fact, was rarely out of some intimate situation for 5 minutes in his life, sharing his friends' houses and tables, and there's the scene, saddening too, worse, of the poet imploring the captain of the ship ferrying him home from Malta to administer an enema to unclog the impacted feces of his laudanum-induced constipation. Daily stuff for Coleridge, he hardly remarks it. Poor man, poor giant. Excruciating for us, spoiled as we are, sanitized, tamed. But what does the life, dope, shit, neurosis, fathers or sons have to do with anything anyway? Think of innocent Claire, 20 years in an insane asylum. And isn't there some fairness, you might think, some justice, but letting yourself think that there's nowhere to go but bitterness, and how regret that deluge of masterpieces to rejoice in. Coleridge, at the end, anyway, found fulfillment. And Claire, too, if not fulfillment, then something, perhaps acceptance, even Hartley, too, something. I was there once in that cottage, a packet of ill-lit rooms, at the very spot beside the hearth where the poem was made, the thin blue flame, that flame which fluttered on the grate. You could still sense something in that comfortless cell resonating with youth and hope, which almost on his deathbed Coleridge wrote, embracing, seen as one, were love. Outside, the glorious lakes, the hills, easy to understand, hoping to stay in such a world forever, and the qualm to tear yourself away. I'm going to read a war poem. There's such a nice atmosphere, one hesitates to do it, but there is this war still going on out there. The poem has some quotes in it. Sometimes I'll say quote, unquote, sometimes I won't because it's fairly obvious. The poem is called Shrapnel. 700 tons per inch, I read, is the force in a bomb or shell in the microsecond after its detonation. And 2,000 feet per second is the speed at which the shrapnel, the materials with which the ordnance is packed, plus its burst steel casing, quote, stretched, thinned and sharpened, unquote, by the tremendous heat and energy, are propelled outwards in an arc until they strike an object and either ricochet or become embedded in it. In the case of insufficiently resistant material, the shreds of shrapnel can cause, quote, significant damage, unquote. In human tissue, for instance, rupturing flesh and blood vessels and shattering and splintering bone. Should no essential organs be involved, the trauma may be termed, quote, superficial, unquote, as by the chief nurse, a nun, in Ian McEwan's Atonement, part of which takes place in a hospital receiving wounded from Dunkirk. It's what she says when a soldier cries, fuck, as her apprentice, the heroine, a young writer-to-be, probes a wound with her forceps to extract one of the many jagged fragments of metal from a soldier's legs. Fuck was not to be countenanced back then. How dare you speak that way, scolds the imperious sister. Your injuries are superficial, so consider yourself lucky and show some courage worthy of your uniform. The man stays still after that, though, quote, he sweated and his knuckles turned white round the iron bedhead, unquote. Only 7 to go, the inexperienced nurse chirps, but the largest chunk, which she saved for last, resists. At one point it catches, protruding from the flesh, quote, he bucked on the bed and hissed through his teeth, unquote. And not until her third resolute tug does the whole, quote, gory 4-inch stiletto of irregular steel, unquote, come clear. Quote, shrapnel throughout the body, unquote, is how a 10-year-old killed in a recent artillery offensive is described. Quote, shrapnel throughout the body, unquote. The phrase is repeated along with the name of each deceased child in the bulletin released as propaganda by our adversaries at whose operatives the barrage was directed. There are photos as well. One shows a father rushing through the street, his face torn with a last frantic hope, his son in his arms, rag limp, chest and abdomen speckled with deep dark gashes and smears of blood. propaganda's function, of course, is exaggeration. The facts are there, though. The child is there or not there. As the shrapnel is no longer there in the leg of the soldier, the girl holds it up for him to see. The man quips, "Run him under the tap, nurse. I'll take him home." Then, quote, he turned to the pillow and began to sob, unquote. Technically, I read, what's been called shrapnel here would have once been defined as splinters or fragments. Shrapnel referred then only to a spherical shell named after its inventor, Lieutenant Henry Shrapnel. First used in 1804, it was, quote, guaranteed to cause heavy casualties, the best man killer the army possessed, unquote. Shrapnel was later awarded a generous stipend in recognition of his contribution, quote, to the state of the art, unquote. Where was I? The nun, the nurse leaves the room, throws up. The fictional soldier, the real child, the father. What becomes of the father? He skids from the screen, from the page, from the mind. Shrapnel's device was superseded by higher powered, more efficient projectiles, obsolete now in their turn. One war passes into the next. One wound is the next and the next. Something howls, something cries. So we'll go to a happier theme, art and life. There's a reference in this poem to Francis Ponge, who was a great French poet who I translated, and to Fragonard, who of course was a great French painter. And Le Monde, which is the French newspaper of record, sort of the New York Times of France. And the poem is called The World. Splendid that I'd revel even more in the butterflies harvesting pollen from the lavender in my father-in-law's garden in Normandie, when I bring to mind Francis Ponge's poem where he transfigures them to levitating matches and the flowers they dip into to unwashed cups. It doesn't work with lavender, but still so lovely, matches, cups, and lovely too to be here in the fragrant summer sunlight, reading. Just now, an essay in Le Monde on Fragonard, his oval oil sketch of a mother opening the bodice of her rosily blushing daughter to demonstrate to a young artist that the girl would be suitable as a, quote, model, unquote. The snide quotation marks insinuate that she might be other than she seems, but to me she seems entirely enchanting, even without her top and with the painter's cane casually lifting her skirt from her ankle. Fragonard needs so little for his plot. The girl's disarranged underslips, a few quick swirls, the mother's compliant mouth a blur, her eyes two dots of black. Yet you can see how crucial this transaction is to her, how accommodating she'd be in working through potential complications. In the shadows behind, a smear of fabric spills from a drawer, a symbol surely, though when one starts thinking symbol, what isn't? Each sprig of lavender lifting jauntily as its sated butterfly departs, Catherine beneath the beech tree with her father and sisters, me watching, everyone and everything and everyone might stand for something else, be something else, though in truth, I can't imagine what. Reality has put itself so solidly before me, there's little need for mystery, except for us. For how we take the world to us and make it more, more than we are, more even than itself. This is called the tract. It's supposed to sort of tumble along. It has no punctuation. I meant it to be recited really quickly. So if sometimes you feel as though you're getting a little lost, don't worry, because we'll capture you back again, the tract. In fact, this poem, when the tsunami thing happened, you'll see in this poem there's some things that are remarkably prescient about that. Let's see. The tract. They're not mine. The prescient stuff was an ancient Hindu text. Where is it, where is it, where is it? In what volume, what text, what treatise, what tract? Is that legend, that tale, that myth, homily, parable, fable that's haunted me since I read it? I thought in Campbell, but I can't find it. Or some scripture, some Veda, not there either. That holy history anyway from those years when I was trying to scull away out of the flat, banal world which so oppressed me, I'm sure because it contained me. Wherever it came from, it's haunted me, lurking in everything I've thought or felt or had happened to me. The protagonist, not anyone special, just a man. He's born, grows, marries, has children. He's living his life like everyone else. Pleasure, pain. Then one day a flood, a deluge, roars through his valley, sweeping all before it away. His house, his village, the people. Only he and his family are left clinging to a tree. Then his wife's torn from his arms, and his children too, one by one. Then the tree is uprooted, and he himself is boiled out into the wild, insatiable waves. He cries out for his life, goes under, comes up, sinks again, and rises to the surface to find himself on an ocean, a vast sea, and looming far above him is a god sleeping. It's Vishnu, if I remember. Vishnu, asleep, swaying serenely like a locust. And as the person gazes in awe, the god wakes, sees the man, plucks him from the waves, and thrusts him into his mouth. And there, in that eternally empty darkness, the man realizes that, oh, all he'd lived, the days, hours, years, the emotions, thoughts, even his family, oh, were illusion. Reality was all along this, God, huge as a storm cloud, the horizonless sea. Not only in depression does that tale come back to attack me. Not only in melancholy am I infected by its annihilating predications, though I've been gloomy enough, often enough, mostly early on about love, then the political bedlam, then work, absurd, writing a word, striking it out, while all around you, as the books of truth say, is suffering and suffering. At first it would take me, yes, during despons, but even at moments of passion, when everything but what you want and the force of your want is obliterated, except at mind's reaches where ancient mills keep heart and brain pumping and some blessed apparatus of emotion and counter-emotion keeps you from weeping with the desolation that lurks in desire. A desolation I don't, thank goodness, feel anymore. Not during passion now does that story secrete its acids through me, but still it does take me. I want to say, when my vigilance flags, when I don't pay attention, then the idea it postulates or the chilling suspicion it confirms leaves me riven with anxiety for all that exists or has ever existed or seemed to. Yet what is there in that no way plausible whatever it is that can still so afflict me, philosophically primitive, spiritually having nothing to do with any tradition, even the tragic, to which I feel linked? If the wisdom it's meant to impart is that you can't countervail misery with gratification, or that to imagine life without suffering is to suffer, I've learned that. And it doesn't make death more daunting. I have death more or less in its place now, though the thought still sears of a consciousness not even one's own extinguished. Not some rage of mentalism, then, something simpler, though more frightening, about love, that the man has negated in him not only the world, but his most precious sentiments. What's dire is that the story denies and so promulgates the notion that one can deny the belief know the conviction that some experiences, love most of all, can, must be exempted from even the most cruelly persuasive skepticism and excluded even from implications of one's own cosmology if they too radically rupture what links real lives one to another. To release yourself from attachment, so from despair, I suppose, was the point of the text. And I suppose I was looking for it again, to release me from it. And if I haven't done that, at least I'm somewhere near the opposite, where I'm hanging on not to a tree in a dream, but to the hope that someday I'll accept without qualm or question that the reality of others, the love of others, the miracle of others, all that which feels like enough is truly enough. No celestial sea, no God and his bark of being, just life. Just hanging on for dear life. Thank you.
You've been listening to Pulitzer Prize-winning poet C.K. Williams. Williams is the author of 9 books of poetry, the most recent of which, The Singing, won the 2003 National Book Award. His previous book, Repair, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. And his collection, Flesh and Blood, received the National Book Critics Circle Award. We began with an introduction from former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Penske. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odeth, with help from Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.